Good morning. Welcome. Thank you for joining us this morning for a very special lecture by Rabbi Moshe Walter. So it's very special for us to have Rabbi Walter lecture on our behalf. I'd like to thank Rabbi Rosenbaum and Yan Gedol Shomrei Emuna for being such a wonderful partner in this program and all that we do here. Thank you very much. I'd also like to thank Rabbi Zakum for his efforts on behalf of the Chayil and for heading this and putting it together. And without further ado, it's my delight and pleasure to introduce Rabbi Walter, a dear friend, Chaver.
Good morning to everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. And I always enjoy speaking at these programs and events. I thank you every winter and to the shul for this wonderful opportunity. I especially thank Rabbi Winter and Rabbi Zakim for encouraging me to speak about this particular topic, which is very close to my heart, very passionate about, and I feel quite strongly about. I think the title is The Dialogue Between the Rabbi and the Questioner in Halacha. This is a topic that I think to many is confusing, and particularly difficult when people hear a rabbi issue, a psak halacha, that it to one person will hear one way and to another person will hear something else. I think a lot of people have a difficulty with that. I'd like to really try to touch on that, try to explain how part of the halakhic process works. I'd like to divide today's lecture into three parts. The first, I'd like to give a brief historical sketch of how the halakhic process works over the millennia. The second, third, which I think will be the lion's share of the talk today, we'll essentially be speaking about the factors that Rabbanim take into account when dealing with questions, when they have questions that they're researching, discussing, dealing with. The final aspect, I'd like to talk about some of the new modes of communication, technology, and how that affects the halakhic process as well. Just mentioned to Mr. Hornstay here that there's something now called an e-rabbi. So I'd like to address how that works also. The earliest dialogue recorded, correspondence between a rabbi and a sholel, a rav and a sholel, probably dates back to the Torah, Parshas Yisrael, where Moshe Rabbeinu, upon the advice of his father-in-law, set up a system, some bezdin, a quasi-bezdin, whereby every question would be dealt with through a face-to-face conversation. The rav and the sholel, in this case, would be Moshe Rabbeinu and Moshe's individuals who Moshe put in charge of the particular questions to be dealt with. Moshe, being the gadol hador, the great rabbi, the sage, would be able to deal with the hardest, most difficult questions, kol kashi v'yun elecha, all the hardest things would be brought to Moshe. The simpler ideas, questions, would be able to be dealt with by others, and that, for that Moshe Rabbeinu set up his court system. There you see, the first time in Jewish history, a system whereby the rabbi and shul, the rabbi and the shul, had a dialogue, had a conversation, communication, and clearly that communication was one that was face-to-face, and that seems to be the simplest, easiest, and most effective way to communicate and to dialogue and to correspond. The rabbi can see the person, the individual, the face, the impressions, the issues that are being dealt with. No different than, you know, when you go to a physician. Not something that's done over the phone. A good diagnostician wants to see the patient and is able to get a good sense of who the person he is dealing with, she is dealing with, and by that way you can get a good sense of what's taking place. That face-to-face dialogue, which I just described, is something that took place in Jewish history through the redaction of the Talmud, up until the Tkufas of Gaonim, somewhere 500 CE, that was the way that all halachic issues were dealt with. Face-to-face dialogue, conversation, communication. The shul would come to the rav would discuss and deal, and they would be able to discuss and ultimately execute a halachic position. Starting in the Gaonim, in the year 500, as I mentioned, a new form of communication developed for the Rabbanim, and that was what we call Piskei Halacha and Tshuvas. Tshuvas are responsa, not that were issued directly via orally, but rather by pen. And the reason for that is that the world became bigger. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't just in the Machane anymore, and Klal Yisrael weren't just surrounding him as it was in the Dor HaMidbar. But ultimately, people spread apart. There were Jews who were beginning to live in, throughout the world, throughout the different parts of the world. And the best mode of communication there was not via a face-to-face communication. You couldn't have somebody travel weeks or months to speak to a particular rav, or if it was a particular town. So certainly there was a continuum of the tradition that I just described, but nonetheless, written responsa became more popular. That mode of communication continued through the Rishonim and really continues till today. And certainly if you would go to a library and you were to ask the librarian to fill up a room of Tshuva Svarim, you could fill up, you know, the entire shul that we are sitting in, room to room, shelves of Sifrei Tshuva that have been written since the Gaonim, since the Rishonim, Achronim, and up until contemporary times. The benefit of a written responsa is that it is written, and anything that is written certainly is set in stone. There's a difference between something that's recorded in pen and paper as opposed to something that's written orally. Sometimes when you write something, it has more and it carries more weight than something that you say. Now, we could argue about that, but nonetheless, what a tshuva does is it allows the questioner to pen the particular question that he or she desires to be answered in the way that he or she is writing the particular question. At the same time, the respondent, the Rav, is able to articulate every single aspect of the issue that's being dealt with, and it can be explained in very, very careful terms. If something is not understood, and this is very common in all responsa literature, you'll see a follow-up tshuva, that the Rav will say, I didn't understand what you meant, the Shul will say, I didn't understand what you meant, clarifying clarifications and back and forth, and you can see often in Sifrei Tshuva, we have three or four series of letters until the respondent is able to feel comfortable issuing and executing a psak halacha. So certainly written response is something that is very popular, very common, and certainly the mode of communication response has been the way that great poskim have issued very, very important tshuvas on very, very serious matters from the heaviest to the lightest throughout Jewish history. And as I said, that continues still today. In the last two decades, we have seen what's called in the academia world the explosion of information. And this explosion of information particularly is found in the area of books. Books have been written en masse in the last two decades, three decades. The National Museum in Israel actually, which does data and statistics and these types of things, says that until 1965, there are 100,000 books, Jewish books that were written, Kodesh and Chol, but written in Hebrew. Since 1965 till date, there are over 300,000 books that have been written. So this information explosion, as it's called, is startling, and it affects a lot of different areas, but the way and the particular place that it affects us, and me specifically today, is in the area of halacha. The amount of halachic literature that exists today is astounding. There's probably not a mitzvah or a siman in Shulchan Aruch that does not have a dedicated book, and I mean a book that deals with a particular discipline, in either of the four sections of Shulchan Aruch, from the most mundane to the most simple to the most complicated and heavy topic, there are books that are dedicated to that particular item. When in Shulchan Aruch was written in the 1500s, and later Achronim and the glosses on the Shulchan Aruch wrote comments on the particular area of halacha, today there are fields that are dedicated to that particular area. Just to give you an example, say for that many might be familiar with, the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa, that was in by Rabbi Shur Neuwirth in the year 1966. That is a classic, or one of the earliest classic, what's called the Sefer Kitzer Halacha Sefer, that details all the halachas of Shabbos from the Erev Shabbos until Moshe Shabbos. It's fantastic and outstanding work that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the Chacham Lubavitcher, worked on with him, and it's become a classic. Many homes probably have a copy of that particular book. To date, that book has been translated to over seven languages, Russian, even in Yiddish, in French, and in Spanish. It's tremendous that book has been translated so much times. What that speaks to essentially is that people are very, very interested in halacha. People want to do the right thing. People are interested in fulfilling the halachas of Shabbos properly. However, at the same time, what it does is it, to a certain extent, limits the relationship between the rabbi and the shoel to a certain extent, because now everybody could access that particular work. The question you should all be questioning and wondering now is, what is the relationship at this point between the rabbi, the rav, and the shoel, when I could access any sefer, any aspect of halacha is available to me. I could go to the library, I could go to the Beis Medrash. Wherever I am, I can access the particular question on the topic that I am researching, the question that exists, and I could take a book and look at it in any language I want. This issue is coupled with the fact, and really is accentuated, when the creation of Rabbi Google. Now, Rabbi Google is able to answer any question. I mean, you just type it in, you punch it in, and he could, Rabbi Google, any way you want to call him, he could answer anything. Now, not only that, you could come up with an article on a topic, you could come up with somebody who's asked that particular question, you could deal with a rabbi who will directly answer your question. These two issues have created a particular struggle and a tension between how specifically your question is being accessed. Now, although there are benefits, and I don't take away from the benefits, and certainly I've taken advantage of them as well, the Sfarim and the ability, the online ability to research topics at a much, much easier rate. What I like to try to discuss with you today, and I like to try to prove, and hopefully everybody will walk out, that although you can gain a lot from both the Sfarim and from the internet, there's a particular challenge and issues that are not being dealt with in your research and questions like that. There are five aspects that I would like to discuss today, five factors that I would like to address this morning that halachic authorities historically have taken into account anytime they research and answer a question that are not being dealt with in an effective way when you're looking at a book and when you are researching a question online. These are things that you're not going to be able to get. Now, although you are more informed and although there is more information that is available and the questioner is becoming more informed and is certainly richer and is able to ask a better question, no different than, I'm the son of a doctor, so no different than if I were to come to the physician and I have more information at my fingertips that I understand the issues, that I'm able to research the issues, I'm more informed that I'm able to really show that I understand a particular diagnosis that's being dealt with, and as a result, I can question, wonder, discuss, and deliberate the particular treatment that's being offered. The same thing is true in halakha, and the Rabbanim appreciate that and enjoy that, but at the end of the day, the particular issues that are not being dealt with, and I would like to share five of those. Throughout Jewish history, the Rabbanim took into account financial considerations very, very heavily. If you look in Yoredeya, one of the most common phrases that you'll see in the Ramah of Moshe Isles, who's the gloss on the Shulchan Aruch, who wrote a little bit of a contemporary of Rabbi Yosef Karo in the mid-1500s, very often said, because of Hefsein Merubah, because of the financial loss, I'm willing to be lenient. Now, how does that work? I mean, either it's mutter or it's usser. How do we take financial considerations into account? How does that work? Why should that be permit something that was really usser? So the Ramah, besides writing a gloss on Shulchan Aruch, also wrote an introduction to his magnum opus on Yoredei, which is called the Taras Katas. And he writes and he explains that you might suspect me and wonder and question why indeed I am being so lenient. And he says, therefore, I'm going to explain to you how it works that I always write because of Hefseid Merubah, because of financial considerations, I'm able to be lenient. I'm going to take the liberty of using my free translation in English of the short, pithy paragraph that he writes regarding this. I excuse myself, says the Ramah, to explain an item so that the inquirer does not suspect me. At times I write leniently in regard to a situation of great financial loss or for a pauper who would suffer heavily or for Kavod Shabbos. The reason for my lenient ruling is because in these areas it seemed to me that there exists room for blanket leniency according to the halacha. Therefore, the Achronim, later commentaries, who were stringent, therefore I wrote that under extenuating circumstances and need, the letter of the law should be established and not the latter stringency. What the Ramah says is that the only time he paskins that something is mutter because of a hefsed movement, because of an extenuating circumstance, is only because originally, according to letter of the law, that item is actually permitted. Since the permission of that particular psak was given, other achronim were machmir over the millennia, and it was said that this particular item should be usher. Says the Ramah, when there's a situation of financial loss, we're going to go back to the letter of the law. That explains the Ramah is why when it comes to finances, we're able to at times pull the situation back and say, let's go back to the letter of the law. Share with you a fascinating, one of the most important stories, the halachic stories. Yes. So again, that a rabbi understands the literature, understands the issue. The Ramah, anytime he writes, Hefsei Berubah, that because of an extenuating circumstance, you could be Mako, that's because he was familiar with the literature that was written before. He knows that according to the letter of the law, this is permitted. Throughout the 200 and 250 years since the development of the halacha, there were certain chumras that were added on to the letter of the law. But the Ramah says in a situation of Kavod Shabbos, if you have guests, and he quotes also a Tshuva Marimintz. Marimintz says that a wealthy person on Erev Shabbos has the same status as the pauper throughout the week. Because on Erev Shabbos, everybody's busy. Everybody's in a rush. You're having guests. So we have to know how to deal with that particular situation. You could be lenient in that regard. The Beis HaLevi, Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, was the author of the same response to Beis HaLevi, also the Rav of Slutsk in the early 1800s. At early point in his tenure in the Rabbanus in Slutsk, he had a knock on his door. A blacksmith came some days prior to Pesach and asked the Rav if he was able to use milk for his 4 cups of wine. That was the question that was posed to the Beis HaLevi. The Beis HaLevi said, and he asked him, like any good rabbi, he asked him a question. He said, are you sick? Are you not well? Are you able to not partake of wine? He said, no, I'm fine. Beis HaLevi asked him, so why then can you not partake or drink wine? He said, I just don't have the money to, spend, to collect, and to be able to pay for 4 cups of wine. Beis HaLevi excused himself in the room, and he came back with 25 rubles. And he gave the man 25 rubles. And the individual said, I didn't come for a handout. I came to ask a question. If I can't have wine, I won't have wine. Is that permitted or is that prohibited? So Beis HaLevi said, look, it's not a handout. It'll be a loan. And when you're able to pay me back, you'll pay me back. The pauper left, and he said, okay, thank you very much. Hopefully I'll be able to repay the loan. When the blacksmith left, Mrs. Beis HaLevi, who was watching this communication, asked her husband, he asked you if he's able to use milk for the dollar kosher. So you told him, maybe yes, maybe no. So instead you were going to give him that amount of money that it cost to buy the wine. But 25 rubles is an extraordinary amount of money. Why are you giving him that much money? It costs 4, 5, 6 rubles for wine. So Beis HaLevi said, if he's asking me if he could have milk for the 4 cups of wine, that means he can't have meat either. This is a person who's not going to have meat and milk at the same meal, so I gave him enough money that he'll be able to have meat as well. Now, that speaks to two things. Number one, the sense that the Rav has to be able to understand what is really being asked. When you're asking a question, you have to analyze the question that's being asked. And the Beis HaLevi understood that this individual's not just asking if he could have milk, but he's also asking, I need help. Please help me. Furthermore, what you see in that story is the ability of a rabbi to answer differently for a different person. Imagine for a second that that individual said that he was unable to partake of wine. It's quite possible that the Beis HaLevi of Soloveitchik would have told him that you could drink something else. You could use another beverage, theoretically, for the dalat kosher. But in this particular situation, since he was able to have him partake of wine, as a result, the Beis HaLevi felt that this was the best way to go. Another biography, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank was the Rav of Yerushalayim in the turn of the century, was an outstanding posek, a very revered posek. He has a sponsor, Har Tzvi, and he had many younger rabbanim used to apprentice him and watch how he dealt with particular questions. A young woman came to him one day and with an egg. Just rabbis don't get questions with eggs anymore. It doesn't happen. But this young woman came to him with an egg and asked the Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank whether or not this egg was kosher or not. Rabbi Frank asked her, where are you coming from? And the young woman said, I'm coming from Shari Chesed. Rabbi Frank lives in Geula, section of Yerushalayim. At that moment that she responded that she's from Shari Chesed, Rabbi Frank said, it's permitted because of financial situation, because of financial constraints. The young woman left, and the rabbis around the table, the young rabbis were shocked, an egg. Why should that be a consideration? Financially, we're talking about a very insignificant sum of money. Why should that be a consideration when it comes to the Psak Halacha? So Rabbi Frank said, this woman walks from Shari Chesed, she said, to Geula. Now, in the 1940s and the 1950s, walking from Shari Chesed to Geula, I'm sure many of you have taken that walk, so today it takes 25 minutes. Then, under the situation that the community was in, and the struggle and the lack of paved roads, that took quite a walk. That wasn't a simple thing. So he explained to him, the fact that she's taking that walk and that her family told her to walk from Shari Chesed to Geula means that she's looking for a Psak Lekula, and that's what she needs. There's room to be lenient based upon what I saw according to certain Psakim, and I'm going to issue a Psak Halacha Lekula. There's a fascinating dialogue amongst contemporary students of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach regarding a Psak that he issued in a particular area of Halacha that was questionable. Until the end of his life, one of his primary students and disciples, Rabbi Yisrael Gan, who today is a Rav in Beit Vegan, was wondering how it could be that the Psak that he was familiar with from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach changed from what he had heard some years ago. and in a printed article on this particular topic, not dealing with the issue of Psak Halacha, Rabbi Ganz writes the following thing. Nistapakti, I was besafek, I was in doubt, im haisa chazara etzlo. Did Rav Shlomo Zalman Ormach change his opinion about this particular issue? Oh, shai is a psak l'shoalim misuyamim, or was this a psak that he delivered to particular individuals? And then he writes in parentheses, asher pa'amim lo ma'atos, it was not a few times, meaning many times, ra'inu psakim shonim l'anashim shonim, we saw Rav Shlomo Zalman Ormach executed and issued piskei halacha different depending who the person was. Mitoch ha'shimush b'chelek ha'chamishi shal ha'shulchan aruch. So it's become famous today as the fifth Shulchan Aruch, you know, there are four sections of Shulchan Aruch. This is what Rav Shlomo Zalman or his students coined the fifth section of Shulchan Aruch, Shayakore lo hachelek harishon, that he called the first section. The fifth section of Shulchan Aruch, says Rabbi Ganz, and Shlomo Zalman Ormach, is using your mind and understanding who the person that you're dealing with is. There's more than just the text, there's more than what it just says in the book, but it's understanding the particular person and what the person is going through that also plays a role in the particular issue that's being dealt with. So we saw this by the Beis HaLevi, we saw this by Shlomo Zalman Ormach, we saw this by Moshe Feinstein, and we will see that in more moments. Soloveitchik classically was a proponent of this derech in Psak Halacha of issuing Piskei Halacha dependent upon the situation and who the particular person was. And again, what I'd like to do now is go through particular areas where you could see how it makes a difference and where those areas are that one might receive a different Psak Halacha. So certainly in the area of financial consideration is the paramount or the primary area where a Rav will issue a different Psak Halacha depending upon the situation, as the Ramah laid down, that it depends who the person is, what their particular situation is. The Pesachei Tshuva writes in Siman Lamed Aleph in Yoredeya, the area of Trefos, where a lot of the discussions about financial loss comes up because we're dealing with animals. Animals are quite a costly endeavor. And certainly the meat business is very, very expensive, and many of the meat that we're eating, so it depends on psakim that are given on financial consideration. The Pesachei Tshuva quotes from a tshuva of the Har HaKarmel, who says that the definition of hefsed is dependent upon each and every single person. There's no algorithm for what we call financial loss. Is it 5%, 10%, 20%, 25%? And halacha is not going to define an amount that we call a loss. Now, he does argue on earlier achronim who seem to indicate, Kivega included, that there might be a particular amount that we would call a hefsed ruba. The accepted psak halacha, and this is the halacha that many, many poskim have followed throughout the ages, is that it depends upon the particular issue. Just like the Ramah quoted from Mari Mint, that on Erev Shabbos we're all considered to be to a certain extent poor because of the time constraints and the guests who might be coming and the inability to cook more to do something else, and as a result, that would be considered a financial loss. And during the week, so it depends upon the person, the particular situation. To give you another practical example of financial issues, as the week from today, Shavuot Batam, as we head into the 3 weeks, so Moshe Feinstein famously writes, when it comes to shaving during the 3 weeks, that if a person is in a situation, a predicament, where shaving will cause a financial loss, so you're permitted to shave. And Moshe Feinstein explains that the minhag to not to shave during the 3 weeks is a minhag, and was never put in place in a situation where it will cause financial loss. So Moshe is more hesitant to be mekel on Shavur Shechalbo, the week when Tisha B'Av falls out upon. And in a very short tshuva, he says, I'm mekel. Now, here's another example. Moshe was forced to follow up in a later edition. And the first tshuva found in Arachayim Chelek Dalet. And Arachayim Chelek Hei, he writes a much longer tshuva explaining the reason for his kula. And much of his discussion centers around what we call financial loss, what the definition of financial loss, is it not making a big deal that you'll make more money, is it losing or not getting the job, is it an interview, is it not an interview, but Moshe Feinstein deals with this at great length, and here again you see the answer to this particular question hinges upon this particular area called financial consideration. The second issue outside and following financial considerations that a Rav will take into account when he's dealing with a shoel is a person's particular background. And for this, I'll quote a tshuva again, Moshe Feinstein, that he was asked about a family from a Rav who was helping bring a family back to Yiddishkeit, and this particular family had an extraordinarily expensive set of china, porcelain dishes. Those of you who are familiar with the halacha of Heksher Kelim are aware that china and porcelain fall under the category of Kli Cheres. Kli Cheres is an earthenware dish, and that is unable to be kashered. Now, this Rav asked Sir Moshe Feinstein, how can we deal with this? This is a complication, it's expensive, and we want to make sure that we could sort of figure out how to handle this situation. Sir Moshe Feinstein deals with this, and he quotes a number of the well-known kulas on this particular issue. There's a Chacham Tzvi, who says if you wait 12 months, and there's a Bala Itter, and the Rishonim who says that if you do Hagala three times, not just one time, there are a number of kulas that he was able to put together with his outstanding knowledge that he was able to be makel. But then, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, there's a reason that I'm going to be makel on top of everything that Elsa says, and he coins a phrase called Takana Sashavim, because of the concern that they will not continue their path in the return to Judaism. And that's what's called Takana Sashavim. And he says, because of Takana Sashavim, I'm willing to be even more makel, and should absolutely permit them to wait 12 months to do Haggalah three times. He doesn't allow them to use it right away, because of the concern of where they're coming from and the inability that they might have to continue their path in the road to return, so Moshe is willing to be makel. So you see here, and this is not the first time, but a number of tshuvas of Moshe Feinstein is willing to use this term. Now he says that many Rabbanim and Poskim over the time have used this kula called Takanas Hashavim. I personally was unable to find other tshuvas where Poskim were writing that because of this particular reason will be makel. But Moshe says that this is a carte blanche heter that's able to be dealt with and used when this situation arises. Did you have a question? Okay. There are other areas where this arises too. Rav Moshe Sternbach, today a very well-known halachic authority in Yerushalayim, he has a whole section in one of his volumes of responsa for questions that Rabbanim have to deal with when dealing with Balei Tshuva. And he's talking to a Rav who is involved in this line of work, and he's speaking to him and explains to him, to this particular rabbi, who questions him, what should be the level of education? How should we educate Balei Tshuva in terms of the mitzvot that they observe and they don't observe? And a priori, one would think that the best way to go is to teach them in the area of severity. If there's a chi of kares, so make sure that they're going to take care of that mitzvah, that aver, and they're not going to do that particular mitzvah or aver anymore. Shtemach writes, no, that's not the correct path. Even though logically, one might think that that should be the way to go. And he explains that the benchmark for teaching Balei Tshuva is in a way that they are going to continue to do what they are doing. Even though in the interim, they might be over terrible Avera, and they might be Mechalom numerous things, and they are in the process, in the path, and they understand, and they are capable of recognizing what they're doing, so you should teach them that what they're doing is wrong, and you should tell them what they should do. But Shomach is concerned, the same concept, Takanas Hashavim, we're concerned and we're nervous, that if you push too hard, or if you bring on certain lessons or areas of halacha that might be too difficult to understand or to appreciate this particular time, they're not going to continue in their path. This, I think, is similar to the concept of Takanas Hashavim, the concern that we have that somebody might not continue, might not want to continue in their path, and as a result, we also don't look at the severity of punishment, but again, the benchmark is in terms of success and inculcating the proper derech and path for this person to continue on. So even though in this area we might not tell a person, you know, you could be makel because of your china or your porcelain, but for this particular person we will be makel. So again, you see that the answer to a question is going to depend who you are and what your background is. A third area where, again, in the tshuvas of Moshe Feinstein you see quite often is that it depends on the religious bend of the particular person. Now, Moshe Feinstein was willing to be take a position on a topic depending on who you are and what you're about. And the tshuva that I often quote when it comes to this point is when it comes to wearing a watch on Shabbos. Here Moshe was talking about wearing a watch in a place that doesn't have an Erev. Is a watch considered to be a masli or a tachshit? Is it considered to be something that's extraneous, or is it considered to be something that is an ornament? And Moshe Feinstein deliberates and deals with the Gemara and the rabbinic literature on the topic and tries to understand what it is. And Rav Moshe finishes the tshuva, and again, you'll excuse my free translation of the last three or four sentences of the tshuva. And he writes, even though for this reason alone, one should not protest against those who wear a wristwatch, it is appropriate for every Ben Torah and one who fears heaven not to wear a watch on Shabbos, in order that one not become lax, which may lead to wearing a watch connected to one's clothes. The only reason that Moshe can really pinpoint asuring wearing a watch is because we're concerned. In earlier times in history, we didn't wear a watch on our wrist. We usually connected it to a particular part, and we were actually carrying. So Moshe has never said, maybe we would revert back to such a situation. Moshe says, that's not so easy to tell everybody not to wear a watch because of that gzerah. Rabbis contemporarily can't make gzerah that you simply can't wear a watch because of what might occur. However, he says, this is how I instruct my students. He tells his students that they shouldn't wear a watch, but he doesn't tell everybody that they can't wear a watch. So certainly when it comes to a area of halacha that's a little bit more gray, where it's not clearly permitted, or it's not clearly prohibited, where it's hard to really address and know for certain whether something is okay or not okay, so Moshe is willing to use a scale of how to deal with this particular issue. For his students, he understands that the way he came out from the sugya was that it should be asur. But he was unwilling to tell the world that that is a problem. And that's the reason many of us, myself included, wear a watch on Shabbos. I'm not a student of Moshe Feinstein. My Rebbeim were a student of Moshe Feinstein. But nonetheless, you get a sense of how Rav Moshe dealt with an area of halacha that was a little more gray. Another area where you see this in the response of Moshe Feinstein is when it comes to Chalav Yisrael. This is also another example of Moshe wrote 3, 4, and 5 different tshuvas on the same topic, because it was a heavy topic. It was a chiddush. Moshe Feinstein, who's all familiar, permits drinking milk, any milk that comes from a cow, because he thinks all milk in this country comes from a cow, especially with the level of authority that the government has over the milk industry. And Moshe was not concerned a bit about the possibility that there might be another type of milk that's mixed into the milk today. And Moshe is famous for being mako in that area. What a lot of people don't know is that Moshe was hesitant to be mako for everybody. And he concludes his final response on this topic writing the following. Therefore, in my first response, where I showed that there's great reason for those who are lenient, which is correct and clear. So Moshe is unequivocally confident saying that what he wrote is absolutely true, and he permits, with no question about it, that it's absolutely permitted. Certainly, however, for Bali Nefesh, it's a hard word to translate, those who are those whose souls are drawn close to God, Bali Nefesh, it is appropriate to be stringent. Now, who's a Bala Nefesh, who's not a Bala Nefesh? Hard to know. Moshe isn't the first to use this concept called Bala Nefesh. The Chafetz Chaim, the Mishnah Berurah, very often says, Bala Nefesh should be machmir, ila Bala Nefesh yesh lahachmir. So again, we don't define, and it's not up to anybody to decide who a Bala Nefesh is. But rabbis understand and know who their clientele is. They know who they're dealing with. And it's understood that if you want to be a Baal Nefesh, so the Rebbe can say, you're more than welcome. This is something that you're able to do. But according to the letter of the law, Rav Moshe Feinstein was absolutely confident, and he writes over and over again in numerous places in these three tshuvas that it's absolutely permitted, with no question about it. And for that reason, Rav Moshe is willing to be lenient. But again, you do see how a religious bend does depend also upon the response that's being given. A fourth issue where a rabbi also has to deal with another variable, and not just the text, is emotional and psychological issues. A rabbi gets a question from a congregant, from an individual, and he notices that this might not be just a question, similar to what we dealt with in the Beis Halevi earlier, but maybe there's more to what is meeting the eye. And in a very famous letter, Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, known as the Stipler, addresses this particular area. He's dealing with a particular psychological disorder, but this letter really states a precedent in terms of how to deal with particular issues that might not just be halachic that come across the Rav table. A man, says Rabbi Kanievsky, who feels that his psychological disorder negatively affects his observance of the Torah must leave all of his actions and performance of mitzvot to the halachic discretion of a chacham. Don't decide for yourself, because you might wind up being more stringent than you have to be. And he says, don't investigate the reason for the halachic ruling whatsoever. This method has proven that he should not know the reason for the ruling. Only the final halacha, and so he should act. For if not, God forbid, he conformed to a terrible disease and ultimately leave Torah observance altogether. So there is another factor that one also has to take into account, that a question that's being asked, one also has to understand the emotional stability of the particular person. Now, clearly, not in every area is financial consideration, is the religious bend, is the religious background, is the emotional or health status of the person who is asking the question going to be dealt with. Not always, but a Rav has to be able to know who he is dealing with. And to throw out, again, a few examples that the postum over the years and centuries have dealt with is in this regard. And again, because we're headed into the 3 weeks, I'll share with you two examples of the 3 weeks. One of the outstanding and the most important commentaries for the Ashkenazim is the Maharil, Rabbi Yaakov Milon. Lived in the 1100s, and the Rama regularly quotes his Piskei Halacha. And the Maharil writes that a person who is not well emotionally, not physically, should be permitted to eat meat during the 9 days. And he writes that it's good for him, it's healthy for him. Now, we could, and maybe psychologists here will tell me that that's not the case today, it doesn't play a role, it doesn't affect any time in issues of medicine, so we always have to know the difference between when the halachic authority was writing what he wrote and how things are different today. But nonetheless, you do see that the Maharil was willing to take into account heavily emotional well-being when it comes to a psak halacha. It's very, very much accepted minigashmas not to eat meat during the 9 days. Sfaradim are more makel about it. But for Ashkenazim, that's not something that we take lightly. But the fact that the Maharil was willing to be lenient when it came to emotional well-being of a person to be makel not to eat meat during the 9 days, again, speaks to this point that for you it's prohibited, for you it's permitted. Later halachic authorities have borrowed and used this Maharil when it comes to another aspect of 3 weeks, also when it comes to listening to music. Now, listening to music in halacha is something that is a later prohibition. It seems that it stems from the fact that weddings are prohibited during this time period, and typically weddings are associated with music, but there nowhere does it say that music is outright prohibited. But that's become the accepted custom during the 3 weeks, certainly the 9 days, the Shavuot Shechalbo. But many poskim have borrowed the psak of Maharil when it came to emotional well-being for eating, when it came to music as well. And many understand that music certainly plays a role in a person's emotional equilibrium. And as a result, tshuvas like the Divrei Yativ and others have been willing to be makel in particular situations. And it's fascinating to read the literature on this topic. But many were willing to take this to the next level, to be makel for this particular person in this particular situation. So although in a book it will say that it's usher to listen to music, although in a book it will say that it's usher to eat meat during the 3 weeks, or during the 9 days, I apologize, nonetheless, for you, it might be okay. A fifth area, where again we see the difference of opinion based upon who the individual is, depends on the community that you live in. And in a fascinating correspondence between two of the great Gedolei Hador, yes? It could be it does also. I didn't see anybody discuss particular when it comes to veils, but during the Shiva, I think there'd be less reason. But yes, there could be, absolutely. And again, it depends upon the particular situation. No. The fifth area that I wanted to address in terms of where we see different psakim that are given is communally. And as I mentioned, in a very, very fascinating correspondence to Moshe Feinstein, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, two of the great lights of the last generation, who corresponded on two or three issues of halacha, corresponded what seemed to have been a very, very important issue 15 years ago, and that was challah. They talk about reheating challah on Friday night. The yeshivas have a common custom to take challah, to eat challah, and to put it back. And they debate the permissibility, propriety of putting it back on. They deal with bones. Whether or not bones that will be put back on, will be cooked again, whether or not that's okay or whether that's not okay. And Rav Moshe Feinstein concludes his tshuva on this topic to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach with the following sentence. I responded at length to explain my lenient halachic opinion. This is Rav Moshe Feinstein speaking. But spare you to be lenient in Eretz Yisrael for those who eat it, since your honor ruled that way stringently and knows better the ways of the citizens of Eretz Yisrael. So although Moshe Feinstein writes a very, very long responsa and a very complicated and tshuva regarding Hilchos Shabbos, Shehiyah and Chazara, he understands that he's writing from some thousand miles away. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is living in the city, and he knows and understands the issue and who he's dealing with, and as a result, Moshe Feinstein was not willing that his written response should become the Psak Halacha for Dore Doros in light of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach understanding the particular situation. Another area where I found a disagreement of opinion between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in terms of Hilchos Shabbos and the community was Hotzah, carrying on Shabbos. Now, in the heat and the hot months, so many of us either don't wear a jacket, or some of us who do wear a jacket will wear a jacket over our shoulders. So Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach debate wearing your jacket without your hands in the sleeves and just putting it on top, whether that is a problem of carrying on Shabbos. And each of them have a totally different response for a totally different reason. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says it's permitted, and you could walk like that in the Rishus HaRabim or in a Carmelis, in the streets of Yerushalayim, because that's the way people wear. People walk around like that. That's commonly done. That's accepted. So therefore, wearing your jacket like that is something that's okay to do. Moshe Feinstein says, no, nobody in this country walks around like that. That's not a common way to walk. So as a result, Moshe says that that's prohibited to do in a place where there's no Erev. A third example where I saw a difference in opinion based upon the culture and the environment where they were living is regarding medication. And specifically when it came to back, difficulties with one's back. And they both deal with the question as to whether or not a heating pad or a hot water bottle is something that's permitted or prohibited to use on Shabbos. Refuah, medication, is something that's prohibited on Shabbos, depending upon the situation, according to the letter of the law. But the question was, when it came to a heating pad and a heating blanket, whether that's prohibited or permitted. And each of them writes, and Rav Nissen Karel, it's also an outstanding postdoc today in Bnei Brak, also says, depends where you are, depends where you live. If it's commonplace to use such a blanket or a heating pad, so you're not doing anything different than anybody else. That's called kida'av de'inchi. It's not derech ha'acholim. This is the way normal human beings go to sleep. They wear a heating pad or a hot water bottle. That's understood. But in certain climates and countries where that's not the common thing to do, and where doing so looks like you are doing it with sorech hafua, it will be prohibited. So clearly we do see that the answer that is given to an individual is very much dependent upon who you are and where you live. Now, the question is that throughout history we see that tshuvas were written internationally, tshuvas were written universally. There were tshuvas written from Israel to America, the tshuvas written from South Africa, throughout the world. One of the great poskim of two generations there, Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, from his seat in Vilna, responded to a plethora of questions. The famous psak on the Erev in Paris, and he answered numerous questions. But the differentiation between when a postdoc was willing to answer a question and when was not willing to answer a question very much depended upon the particular question that was being posed. And I think here specifically, that question has to be left in the hands of a rav. Many times, the rabbanim, myself included, look for more expert advice. A particular area is not something that I research, understand as well. So we want to ask somebody else. So we do turn to another person or another rabbi, a more experienced rabbi, somebody who dealt with that particular area and has researched it more seriously. But that's something that should be left to the hands of the rabbi to decide, is this a question that should be passed along? Because more often than not, a rabbi from out of town who's answering a question doesn't appreciate or doesn't understand or doesn't really recognize the majority or the dynamics of a particular community, understand the particular issues of that individual. These five issues really that I just outlined, financial components, religious background, the religious bend of an individual, the community, and emotional psychological issues, are five areas that are often not taken into account enough and that are not often accessed enough. The greatest halachic authorities throughout the hundreds of years that we have rabbinic literature about regularly look toward these things and take them into account, again, depending upon the situation. There are times when none of these five issues are taken into account. There are times when one of the five, there are times when all five, depending upon the particular question. The challenge that exists is that today, when either an individual will look in a book, or when an individual will simply email a question to a rabbi, or Google an answer to a particular question, these five issues are not being taken into account, and the challenge and the threat in terms of the proper approach to the correspondence between the rabbi and the shul, which has existed for generations, is at a serious loss, because here we have people who might wind up being more machmir than they have to be. And I think more often than not, the understanding is that I've seen this certainly, the psychological approach of many is to want to be more stringent. I think that's the general culture that many have. If I don't know, so I'm more stringent. And certainly the Gemara speaks to the concept and says, koach dehetera adif. It's better to be lenient. The more you know, the more lenient you be, the more access you have to information. Again, no different than a physician who understands and appreciates, besides just the cardiologist who you're looking at his heart, he understands that there are other things and other aspects to take into account also. The rabbi also has other tools in his pocket that he also has to be able to access, and depending upon that particular situation, they have to be accessed. If they're not accessed, and an individual is asking a question and dealing with somebody else who doesn't know or is not a person, then those are certainly failing to be accessed. Yes?
Two questions. The first relates to what you just said. How does the rabbi at the end of a letter or an email, and they're doing the same thing, understand some of these five characteristics? I mean, he's talking to the rabbi who has the person in front of him. You see that person's reaction.
Oh, good.
And he has questions about the community.
Absolutely. Correct. I'm going to talk about that now.
How did that work out? Because you said it started in the year 500, but for the last 1,600 years, they have been able to get around it.
I'm going to talk about that right now.
The second question goes to this. The sponsor, are loaded with the tarot. That's what the library do. They come up with a heter. If they have to, they keep it sponsored. If I look at the published response, I see that, I can do something on Shabbos today, and I do it, even though maybe I shouldn't, or where is there a debate?
Yeah.
There's a debate. You don't necessarily see that in the written response. You see is how they manage to go off of the debate. Usually they go off.
I'm speaking to your point exactly. I mean, Moshe Feinstein himself writes in the introduction to his responsa that people shouldn't open my sefer and paskin based upon what I write. Now, it's an interesting point because tshuvas are published to be used and to be accessed. So, and we know that rabbis are quoting the pesukim of Moshe Feinstein regularly. But nonetheless, Moshe Feinstein understood that this specifically, that just because I wrote something to this person does not mean that it's true for somebody else. Just last week, I was talking to a colleague and we were discussing a particular tshuva of Moshe Feinstein. He says that his father-in-law, also Rav Asher Moshe Feinstein, the same question. Moshe told him something else. Now, that doesn't mean that he had two different books, and depending upon who it was, he would answer differently. The situation is different, and no different than a physician when he's diagnosing an individual. So the same disease, there's a particular way to deal with it for this patient, there's a particular way to deal with it for this patient. The same is true when it comes to answering a halachic question, that depending upon the greater good, or depending upon the person, we also have to take that into account. Somebody said that to me right before the lecture. Mr. Hortzay told me, my phone's going to be going off the hook after this.
Okay.
Okay, so it's an excellent question. In shul, I've said numerous times publicly that I have found so many times that people call me, and I wish they would have called me earlier, because they wound up being stringent on serious issues, on serious, serious matters. And if they would only have called, we could have got them out of this issue much easier, much easier. And there are a plethora of examples where this comes up. The rabbi appreciates being called because he could help somebody. That's why he's in the business. Now, we often get questions that are silly and that are, you know, don't necessarily need the rabbi to deal with. But, you know, that's part of the course, that, you know, part of this is taking questions that are not going to be as important, but in light of the answers that we're able to give to serious questions, we do think that it's very important. So, yes, you have to balance, and we'll talk now about contemporary forms of communication. I think I'll speak to your point more. You mentioned Eliot's email and fax, I think, and written responsa. So let's talk about more modern-day communications and the way we communicate today and how that affects the general makeup of Psak Halacha today. If an email and if a fax is being used like yesterday's tshuva, so it would seem to be that that's a very responsible way of communicating between the Rav and the Shalom. Writing something down gives a person the sense of the issue, it clarifies the issue for the questioner, and it gives the rabbi an opportunity to read something carefully. The challenge today is that because of the mode of communication, it's expected to be responded to so fast that puts everybody under pressure. If you don't respond to an email within 24 hours, that's considered to be irresponsible. That's fine. That's today what it's expected. But at the same time, we have to appreciate that in order to research a question that has not been dealt with yet, or to deal with a particular issue that is not necessarily the tip of the fingers of the rabbi who is responding, he may need more time. But if an email and a fax are being dealt with as a pen and paper were hundreds of years ago, it would seem to be that that would be the best way, and that would be an appropriate way to deal with questions. Certainly it gives the rabbi time, it gives the responder time, and everybody's able to deal with a particular issue in an efficient and a responsible way. There's not much written about contemporary modes of communication in the world of halacha, but there's a fascinating comment, Rabbi Leo Henkin, who was one of the great poskim of contemporary Moshe Feinstein, writes about the telephone. Now, the telephone to us is something that's commonplace. Everybody uses a phone. But as the phone became more popular, Rabbi Henkin wrote a scathing attack on answering questions through the phone. Now, today, that's what we all do. So listen to what he writes, and I think it's important, and he's not the only one. Those who ask questions over the phone are not acting appropriately. Now, Rav Henkin was a major mako, very, very famous for being lenient. When one asks the Rav a halacha question face-to-face, and this speaks to what you said, Eliot, the Rav then has the time to look into a sefer and to consider the issue. If it happens that the Rav overturns his own ruling, he can then repair the mistake as he knows the individual and where he lives, opposed to when he answers over the phone hurriedly and is bound to make a mistake. If the Rav later wants to overrule the response he issued, he does not know who the Shoel was. This is before caller ID. And there is no way to repair the problem. As a result, there are rabbis who do not answer Shilos over the phone. The Shoel is certainly not acting appropriately when he does not ask a question face-to-face. If the Shoel must ask a question over the phone, he should certainly mention his name and his address. This is Rav Henkin wrote not so long ago, about 55 years ago, Rav Henkin wrote this. Now, I did a little research, and Rav Henkin was not the only Rav who felt this way. Rav Soloveitchik encouraged his students not to answer questions over the phone. He writes this in an address at a Chag HaSmicha. He tells us the rabbis, they should not answer questions over the phone. In writing, I found two contemporary postmen of the same approach. Rav Moshe Sternbach, I quoted earlier, and Rav Nissen Karelf also say that the rabbis shouldn't answer questions over the phone. And serendipitously, I bumped into an address that Rav Schwab was giving upon Divine Providence, Hashgacha Pratis, and he writes that he was answering a question over the phone, and he felt terrible for doing so because he realized he made a mistake and he couldn't call the person back. And he said, Min HaShemayim, for some reason, the person called him back later that night because he wasn't sure what the Rav said, and he was able to fix the problem. But it's striking that five great rabbis are concerned and nervous about answering over the phone. Clearly, this is not the approach that any of us take today, and that no Rav doesn't answer a question over the phone. Rabbanim do appreciate and prefer dealing with people face-to-face. Certainly, there are certain questions that do not belong over the phone and that should be dealt with in a face-to-face communication. But the majority of questions can be dealt with over the phone. Many of them can be dealt with properly. And truth be told, it's interesting. Rav Vosner, who was the great posek in Zichron Yaakov, who has recently passed away, says that he specifically set up a phone system whereby people can ask questions anonymously. And he thought that was very important, that people often don't want to see the rabbi, don't want to face the rabbi. So it's a whole different way to look at this, as opposed to Soloveitchik and Rabbi Karel, who felt that it's important. Tell me your name, what's your address, where do you live, I want to get back to you. Rav Vosner felt that that's not appropriate necessarily, because let a person be anonymous. At times that's an important thing as well. So again, there is a tension when it comes to how to deal with questions over the phone, but as I mentioned, this is certainly the common approach today, is that we answer questions over the phone, and we have ways of getting back to people, but nonetheless, we do have to take into account the fact that a face-to-face dialogue is much more productive. And as the Beis Halev was able to see and feel and recognize the face of the person, who he was dealing with, how the blacksmith was, Rabbi Frank and the young woman who came to him with the egg, certainly, when you're speaking to somebody, talking to somebody, you get a sense of what you're dealing with, who you're dealing with, and you know to handle how to handle a particular issue. The issue that is most complicated and that I find the most stressful is texting. Now, texting is the mode of communication today. It is the most popular, it's the cheapest, it's the fastest, it's the most effective. How does that affect the communication between the rabbi and the shalom? Many rabbis are answering questions through text. There's a rabbi in Israel who now published 2 volumes of response over the text that he gave, Rav Aviner. He has and very heavy questions. I mean, Pikuach Nefesh, he's answering to Chayalim and the Tzahal, very serious questions on the text. I was very troubled by this, and I let's talk about texting for a few minutes. The reason for the success of texting is twofold. It's cheap, it's effective, it's fast. You don't have to speak so much. You could skirt particular words. And you're able to get a lot of information across in a short amount of time, and the responses come at a rapid fire. The difficulty is, and I found this, is you could leave a communication over the text with a totally different understanding that the person had. This happens over and over and over and over again. The rabbi can think he said one thing, and the questioner could think that the rabbi said something else. And there are times where that's a pretty serious mistake that is about to take place. The rapid fire by which the question and the answer are given, also the success in the text is that I could skip words, I don't have to use words. Words are very important. The Prima Gadim, Yosef Tumim, in his address, where he talks about Psak Halacha, he says that the words that a person gives, and he encourages not to send young children to the rabbi to ask the question, because the child might not use the right words, and words are important. When it comes to a text, if I'm missing particular words, so I'm missing an entire body of the question. And for the rabbi to start asking over the text, so you're not using the text properly. That's not what it's supposed to be. So there are certain times where text is helpful, and certainly when it comes to is this hashgacha okay? Is that hashgacha okay? Or they're basic questions that you could deal with. But certainly when it comes to areas of halacha that require the questioner to be more verbose and the respondent to be more patient and needs the time to answer the question, there is a concern when we deal with questions in that way. And certainly this is becoming very, very popular. But we do have to be careful. And I think it's important to be careful in this particular area, specifically when it comes to heavier questions. So certainly in light of the modern day communication, the communication that we have to recognize that the ideal situation is the way Yisro set up and the way Moshe created, and that's a face-to-face dialogue. And I would certainly say when it comes to heavier issues, that should certainly be the call of the hour. When it comes to different areas and different types of questions, certainly the email and the text that we discussed can take those issues into account, no different than the paper and the pen did, you know, hundreds of years ago. But at the same time, the failure to be able to recognize that these 5 issues, which I articulated, the financial consideration, the person's background, the religious bend, the emotional issues, or the communal questions, in the global village that we live in, the papers that we're reading, the essays that we are accessing to answer particular questions, have the ability to really curve the halachic process in a way not only that it's going to universally change because of the way that we are dealing with it, but for the particular questioner, so the difficulty becomes that you're not having your question addressed to you. And a tailor-made response is really something that we've seen take place over the years. So in an effort to try to recreate and to make sure that that succeeds and that continues to succeed, so certainly we have to try to encourage and to find a way where questions and answers are being asked and answered in a forum where it's being dealt with responsibly. Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions? I'm happy. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I think it's important, but in the that if you study enough, you can come across.
It's a very good question. I think the more experienced you are, the more you're able to access these five areas. And the more you know, the more you're able to research something and understand how to deal with the particular case. You know, the way halacha works is that there's the corpus of Talmud, then there's Rishonim, and then there's the Shulchan Aruch, and then there are Achronim. So you have to learn and understand, and what a rabbi is able to do that you don't get in a book is to know how to balance and to know how to look at something. So when you're at your Shabbos table and a question comes up and you pull out the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa, so you just see that one line of what he says. But a rabbi might look at the footnotes, and the footnote that he has for that is something that might not be so authoritative that he's quoting to permit that particular thing. So the rabbi can look in another sefer, and he knows how to balance the question and the issues and the sources that are being dealt with. And balance in halachic literature is very important, because you could have, on the one hand, a very authoritative source say one thing, and you could have a very unauthoritative source say something else. And to the average person, it just might be one versus one. But to somebody who understands the halachic process a little bit better, so we recognize that when one person writes something or five people write something and one person writes something else, that has a different effect.
So is it that only after 7 years of bouncing around in experience you come to figure out five elements one should look at?
So these five elements are five elements that I sort of put together.
Right.
But I think if you were to ask any Rav, this would be something that a good rabbi would be able to use and to access and to understand when he's answering such a question. And certainly, as you're learning, you begin to recognize how to approach a text and how to approach responsa, which responsa literature carries more weight, which responsa literature carries less weight. When a rabbi is saying something more radical, you recognize that it's a radical position. So we have to learn that as well.
Although you touched it a little bit, is the extent to which a posse consults experts.
Yes, I touched on that only briefly. You're right. Yeah, absolutely. This is I'll quote you a tshuva of the Nodi Behuda. The Nodi Behuda, Rabbi Chaska Landau, writes a scathing tshuva to a student of his who passed in on a very, very chamor, on a very stringent area of halacha, without asking him. And the Buddha says, you don't have the right to answer such a question. You don't have the experience. This was a rub of a town in Europe. You can imagine in the 1700s, to get it to have a shteller in that particular town meant that you were already a heavyweight. But the Nodi Behuda writes to say, you shouldn't have responded to that particular issue. You don't have enough experience, and that's not an area that you should have responded to. But what I do stress, and I think it's important, is that a shoel leave that to the rabbi to decide when to ask the expert advice. Because if you, as a shoel, are going to look for the expert on your own, so the expert might not be in your community, and he's not going to be able to take into account that communal aspect, that, and he doesn't know you particularly. So allow the rabbi to research the question, to deal with the question, and when it comes to the, you know, banging the gavel, so you'll leave that to somebody else, but allow the rabbi to do that that as well. But certainly consulting is the name of the game. There's no question about it. Questions that we're more familiar with, we're able to answer. Questions that are more complicated. And today, certainly, proficiency in all areas of halacha is not common, and specialization is. Kashrus, they're specialists. In medical areas, they're specialists. Every rabbi has a particular area of specialty, and there are certain people who are not rabbis who have particular areas of specialty. When I have a particular medical issue, so I speak to this person, but I don't not research the topic because I'm able to learn more, and then I ask the expert how he would deal with that question. So being blind is certainly not a good idea. We learn a lot from the people who ask us questions, and I think questioners have the ability to learn a lot more today also in terms of research and coming to the rabbi with more information. It's always a challenge for me when somebody asks me a question, I see that he did research, that she did research, and it allows me to research the topic more seriously and to come back with, I think, a more professional response. Yeah. I just see you didn't ask a question. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I want to suggest to the gentleman who asked the question back there that there is a husband that says, Kinella
Harav. Acquire for yourself a rabbi. Partly
because. A Selah Harav,
it's a Mishnah.
Knei
lecha chaver.
Right. Okay.
Both are important.
But there is an element of empathy, of the rabbi's own personal experiences. The rabbi knows you and your family history and your medical needs or whatever it is. There's a certain, hopefully, a very, you know, close relationship that you trust this person.
though you may not be very knowledgeable, as I am not, you sometimes have to know at least enough to start the conversation, or at least give a temporary answer to a very important question. Sometimes you can't even tell. It's an emergency. A doctor is looking at you and says, "What do I do now?" And you say, "Can I call a rabbi?" And it's Shabbat, so the rabbi's not going to have his cell phone in his pocket.
Right.
Or it's just, no, we have to do it now. And it's just something, I think an ongoing educational process like this is very important, because we have to know some basic things so that we can respond.
No question. I think the more transparency there is, and the more rabbis are able to share with the particular person what the issue is. And you read this in Tshuva Sarim. The rabbi says, this is a question, and the reasons for my leniency are X, Y, and Z. But that means that it's for Reuven or Leah, and not for Sarah and for Shimon. And every question really has to be taken and has to be tailor-made for that particular person.
It's important to understand the
thinking. No question.
If something, variation of it,
sure,
you're able to deal with it.
There are tshuvas where I've seen where rabbis write, this is what I'm giving you, the general idea, but let's talk about this in person.
Right.
Moshe Feinstein writes on a few places. Yeah?
Okay, so my question comes from the opposite direction. This concept of Amunat Chachamim, this idea of, I don't know the answer, so I'm going to ask the idea of Amunat Chachamim, is that about the love, the local love? Is it about great rebellion?
So,
What is that?
So when it comes, that term is used less in halachic literature and more when it comes to hashkafa, or what they call das Torah. I don't know if that's what you're referring to. But when it comes to issues of halacha, so it's nothing to do with belief. The rabbi has the academic knowledge and the intellectual understanding to state facts. So when you ask the rabbi a question, it's not that you just trust that everything he's going to say is going to be okay. The rabbi is coming from somewhere, and he's coming from literature, he's coming from written statements and from documents. When it comes to belief and halacha are two totally are antonyms, I would say. Halacha is facts, it's information, it's written information, and there's no room for belief. This is what it is. Now, the place for belief is that different rabbis give different answers, and I sure hope that what my rabbi told me is the right answer, because I'm working with him. And on Yom Kippur, I clap al chait because, you know, I may have made a mistake. But the trust is that I trust the rabbi, that he gave me the right answer based upon his researching, but not because there's a whole series of responses called Sheol Zetshuvas Min HaShemayim, one of the Balei Tosfos wrote, that he had Ruach HaKodesh and he got answers from the heaven. None of us work like that. That's not something to do. We research questions, we take the question seriously, and we look for a response. So there's no emunah involved at all.
Is there more of a time element today than there was before? I mean, I remember the classic question was a woman who walked down the street with a rabbi and said, "Rabbi, is this chicken kosher?"
Right.
But also, can I see something? Is it right? Nowadays, we have all kinds of medical issues that have a time element.
Yeah, there are.
So speed is a vast thing. As a fact, speedy communication method sort of pushes us.
Yes, so that.
You know, the letter that used to be written, so
100%. Absolutely. There's no question. Like everything in life, there are benefits and there are challenges. And, you know, certainly the ability to respond. Like there's, in halacha and Choshen Mishpat, there's something called Inui Hadin. When somebody comes to Beis Din and two parties come to Beis Din, so the rabbis are charged to deal with this efficiently and quickly and responsibly. To drag out a case is not in the best interest of either party, and that's halachically inappropriate. The same thing is true in aspects of Rechaim and Yoredeya and Eben Ezer. If a question comes up, so it has to be responded. The tension is that today the expectation is for such a quick response that it does not necessarily always allow the respondent the amount of time that he needs to respond appropriately, and that's with email, that's with text. But if the questioners understand that the rabbi is dealing with a question and he will use modern technology to answer and to address that question as soon as possible. He doesn't have to lick the envelope and stamp the stamp, but he'll get the response back to you electronically as quickly as possible. I think that's it's an incredible thing. Absolutely. Yes, very much. Very much. Okay. Yeah, one more question. That's a great question. You're asking what's between a tshuva sefer versus the code. There's I'll give you a few examples. The Rush, one of the great halakhic authorities who the Shulchan Aruch accesses regularly, says something in his psukim that he writes on the Gemara, and then he says something different in tshuva. That happens regularly. The Shulchan Aruch has, the Rav Yosef Karo has tshuvos, and he also has his sefer Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah has tshuvos at Ramah, and he also has glosses to the Shulchan Aruch. We often find inconsistencies between the two. There are two ways to resolve that. Either the later comment that the Rav wrote is the more contemporary and the more correct because he changed his mind. Then the Steich Emet has a whole long essay where he writes that tshuvas are more authoritative than that which it says in the codes, because tshuvas, and speak for what we're discussing today, dealt with a practical question. And when you're dealing with a practical question, the rabbi speaking to that individual, that means that that's the fact that he really goes with. What it says in Shulchan Aruch, what it says in the Ramah, that's the outline, that's the general idea. But there could be other parameters or other variables, and if you see that's what was written there, then you go to the tshuva. So typically we often say, and the accepted approach is that tshuva svarim are more authoritative. What a rabbi wrote in a tshuva sefer is more authoritative than what he wrote in his written treatise. Again, you have to be dealing with a rabbi who did both. He wrote a tshuva sefer and he also wrote a code. But when it comes to the Rush, the Shulchan Aruch, and the Ramah, so the understanding is, and the Rambam also. The Rambam wrote his magnum opus, the Yad HaChazak, and he also wrote tshuva, the Rambam. And very often we look to the tshuva that was more authoritative than the code. It's a good question. Yeah. Sure. It's a very good question. So I may have read it too quickly, but the Ramah, when he writes and he deals with his financial considerations, so he says at the end, I don't think I read this actually, nonetheless, the custom is to explain to them the reasons. That means the rabbi should explain to the questioner why he's being lenient. This one because of his lack of funds, this one because of Kavod Shabbos, in order that they not wonder that at times there is leniency and at times there is not. The more the rabbi explains, and the more transparency there is, and the more he explains to the questioner why he was lenient, that leaves less room for misunderstanding in the future. So yes, absolutely. Whenever questions are brought my way, and I feel that it's something that may become confused, I'm very careful so to tell the questioner this is a unique situation, and recognize that this is the reason that I'm being lenient. But don't just assume that this is the carte blanche rule for the entire community. Good question. Okay, that's cool. Thank you for coming, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi Walter. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Hopefully, we'll have more of an appreciation of asking a careful question, and also what the Rabbanim, the care and deliberation that and sensitivity that they have for us in their questions. So, thank you very, very much, and have a great day.